welcome to Pints with Treebeard. I'm Jameson Winter, and I'm the Dean of the Upper School at Augustine School here in Jackson, Tennessee. Today, I have the pleasure of being joined by Joshua Edgren. Josh, what do you want the people to know about you?
Oh, so many things. I'm Josh Edgren. I'm a pastor and teacher in Moscow, Idaho. That'll do for now. What are we talking about today, sir? What's the word?
Well, today we're moving back to another Dadcraft episode. We're talking about the idea broadly of pushing your kids' limits, why that's important, why it's particularly important for dads to be a part of this and to be leading the charge, so to speak. Your wife has a part to play in this as well, but you will set the tone and the pace, so to speak, throughout your kids' lives. And at the beginning, I wanted to just start by tying it to the concept of paideia, because sometimes people think, you know, you have dads that can go different ways where people push really hard and they want their kids to like get strong and be ready for the world by making them sleep outside and, you know, cooking all of their own food from the time that they were four and all of those things. And that's maybe one way of taking this. And then other dads might think, well, I don't want to do that, and so I'm going to do everything for my kids. And in the name of being sacrificial, I'm going to serve them and do everything for them. And you also actually don't want to do that either. You want to sacrifice for them, but if you do everything for them, they don't actually learn. And you're robbing them of the ability to grow. And so there's this kind of idea that we need to embody that, yes, we are serving our kids, but we also must push them. We must help them to recognize when they can overcome their limits. And the fact that that goes awry in so many different ways just reemphasizes the need for us to have this conversation and think through it together. So I want to start by tying this explicitly to the word paideia. We've talked about this on the podcast. This is the Greek word that Paul uses for, you know, raising your children up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. This is a Greek word that referred to everything you need to learn to become a virtuous citizen. So everything from how you speak to the way that you tuck your toga to the virtues that you embody and learn as a citizen in Greek society. And it touches every area of life. This is part of that, right? It's not an optional thing. It's part of paideia for our kids, teaching them how to walk in hardship and go beyond their limits and endure beyond what they were thinking they could do. And it's a blessing to them that bears great fruit in their lives. But I want to take a step back and just kind of frame it this way. It's actually very natural for us to want to endure hard things and teach our kids to endure hard things by pushing their limits. Because if we're going to be like Christ, well, he did the hardest things. He took on human flesh, but he is God, right? So he came down and dwelt among us as a creature. He was tempted in every way that we are tempted, and yet he didn't cave like we do. He suffered on the cross and bore the penalty for our sins and then was raised from the dead, right? He suffered something that we will not have to suffer, the wrath of God. And so I think it's important just to start there, that we push our kids' limits not because we want them to be hardened and gritty and tough. That might be true to some degree, but we first and foremost want them to be like Christ.
Yeah, you're right. To ground this in the need, the exhortation to give our children a Christian worldview, right? To shape them into men and women who are going to be and are continuing to be conformed to the image of Christ. Yeah, you're right. This isn't either to project, you know, us onto our children. Either way, right? I think that was well done. You have some fathers who are inclined to say, yeah, I'm going to make them tough, right? Because they got to be tough in this big, scary world. And then you got the other side is like, yeah, my parents did that to me. They made me sleep outside when I was four. I didn't like it. Not doing that again, right? So my children, I'm going to coddle, right? But this isn't about us projecting ourselves onto our children. This is about us trying to make our children like Jesus in the same way that we are called to be like Jesus. This is a theme that we've touched on throughout these episodes, more so in the early ones about, you know, big picture parenting, big picture fatherhood. But it's essential to have in mind for this in particular. We have to treat our children like people. They're little people whom we have been given the duty, the joy, the privilege, and the trials of shaping, right? But we can't lose sight of the fact that they are people, meaning that we shouldn't and oughtn't to treat them as if they were pets, or as if they were less than human. We should be always drawing them up to maturity, not, again, to be like us, but to be like Jesus.
To that end, we can say, you know, here at the outset, to remember our children's frame, right? That's a key principle here. What stage of life your child is in will determine how and to what degree you push their limits and have them face hard things. That's just obvious. It should be obvious. And yet we can go astray there because we're tempted to think they can handle more than they can sometimes, or we're tempted to think that they can't handle anything yet. And that's also not true. And that's also a mistake that we can make. And the second thing that's maybe similarly tied to that is one of the temptations we can face to push our kids well beyond their limits is when our dignity is on the line and when we're doing it for our dignity, right? Do I want my son to jump in the pool because I know it will be good for him and it will form him even though it's scary? Or do I want him to jump in the pool because I don't want to be embarrassed in front of the other parents, right? That has to be crystal clear in our, and I would much rather make the mistake, so to speak, of not pushing my kid at all because I was motivated by wrong thoughts in the moment. I was motivated by, you know, selfishness or vanity or something like that, and then address that battle later and push him in some other way when I've corrected that, then push him and realize, wow, I've actually, in trying to quote unquote train you up, I have been in sin. I've been engaged in vanity and pride, and I've made you into my object of vanity and pride and committed idolatry before the Lord. And so that's the kind of dehumanizing element that can be at play here, right? Is to treat our children as less than human in that way and use them as an object for us to gain renown or for us to gain honor. And that just can't be the case. Discipline, paideia, is always for the child's sake, not for our vindication, not for our satisfaction or pleasure.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Could not agree more. And this is an area where it's particularly, the temptation to do so is particularly acute. Because we rightly want our children to be overcomers, right? To be strong and brave and valiant, to be, like those listed in, you know, Hebrews 11, a hall of faith. We want them to be those sorts of champions. And it's not wrong to want that, but it is so easy to want that not for the glory of God, the advancement of his kingdom, and the good of my child, but for the glory of this guy, right? That's you can want the same thing for idolatrous reasons or for godly reasons. Another thing that maybe makes sense to state at the outset is this is one area where the raising of sons and the raising of daughters will not look quite the same. So as we go on, we'll spell that out, hopefully with greater specificity. Right now, we're still talking generally, and I think it's fair to lump the boys and girls together, but this is an area where there's an asymmetry.
Yeah, and we'll have to be more specific because I'm going to ask you questions about that. I am not very far along into this girl dad thing, so I'm looking forward to your thoughts there and how it's been different for your girls versus Benaiah. And just, you've got not only boys and girls, but older boys and girls, right? Or an older boy and some older girls. So I look forward to hearing you kind of tease some of those differences out because I think I could intuit some of them to some degree, but you know, how much of this is intuitive? Not a lot, right? You've got to learn through mistakes, through imitation, and those sorts of things. So one thing just as a heading, I'd like to talk about Hebrews 12, but before we get there, one thing as a heading to kind of play off of what you were saying is that ultimately, when we're pushing our kids' limits in this way, in this good way, this positive way that's for their good and not for our own kind of selfish interests, we're just imitating God in what he does with his children. So there are so many people we could draw from, but Abraham is a great example of God being his father, walking with him in very hard circumstances, demanding of him great faith, demanding of him a great amount of trust that he would actually provide for Abraham and take care of him. I mean, all the way from the beginning when he calls him and he takes him to a new land away from his family, up to the sacrifice of Isaac, right? That Abraham trusts God and he believes that God will provide. And that's something that is very kind of cutesy, like a Sunday school idea in our heads so often. But when I talk about this, I don't know if I've mentioned with you, but when I talk about this story with students, I call attention to the fact that Abraham bound Isaac and put him on the altar and ask them to think about what that would have been like. Why did he have to bind Isaac? Might Isaac have been resisting? Might he have been shouting at Abraham, "What do you mean God called you to sacrifice me? That's like what the pagans do." That he said he wasn't like that, those gods, right? He said that you're going to worship me and I'm different. I'm the true creator God. You know, who knows what exactly he said, but he has to be bound for a reason. And that's in the text. And then obviously God provides the ram, but Abraham doesn't know that. He trusts, as the author of Hebrews tells us, that God was even able to raise him from the dead, but he knew the promised seed was coming through Isaac. And so he trusts that, yes, this is hard. Yes, I don't understand how I'm possibly going to pull this off or make it through, but I also trust my God. And I know that he will protect me, he will care for me, he will provide what I need, and he does every time.
And the beginning of that passage explicitly says, you know, then the Lord tested Abraham. And the Hebrew word can also be translated tempted, right? The idea is that he put Abraham in this intensely difficult position and did it on purpose for the sake of proving what Abraham was, who Abraham was, who he had become, and ultimately proving his devotion to his God, proving his faith in his God. So that's what God does. He puts his children in very intensely difficult circumstances for the sake of refining them, for the sake of proving them. So we're called to do the same.
And one thing that then translates to us and our children is just as God is refining them and calling for greater trust, we are also doing that with our children. We are calling for them to trust us. Literally, when you stand with your hands out and your kid's about to jump off the diving board and you say, "I'll catch you," you're telling them that and you want them to trust you, which means you got to be trustworthy. You need to be able to back up whatever you're telling them will be true, which is you're not going to fall and hit the ground. And you know, that happens one time as a kid and it can be bad, but maybe you move past it. If that happens regularly when you're testing your children in this way and you keep dropping them and you keep, you know, fumbling, so to speak, sometimes literally, then they're going to ask themselves, "Can I trust you?" And so again, you have to have great care, not only in what stage they are in, but also, am I making promises that I'm not keeping in these moments?
Yeah. As we've talked about before, one of the things that a father does is he shows his children what God is like. And we've talked about obedience to parents being like the most important thing just about that a child learns. He has to learn obedience to his earthly parents. But that's not because his earthly parents are ultimate ends, but rather because by learning obedience to his earthly parents, he will learn obedience to his heavenly father, right? But the same thing actually applies for faith here. The end for Abraham was faith, right? What was proven was his faith in God, his faith to raise Isaac from the dead. And that is an end. For us, our for our children to have faith in us must not be an end, but it is a means, right? Just like obedience to us is not an end, but it is a means. The means, namely, being that they might obey their father, right? Our children learn to have faith in us, and, well, by learning to have faith in us, they learn to have faith in their God. It's actually kind of the same move. You're teaching them what God is like when you put out your hands and say, jump to me. And they go, I can't, I won't, I will fall. And you say, no, you won't. Yes, you can. Jump. And they go, okay. And they jump, and then you catch them. And they go, oh, my perception of reality, that I would fall and break my every bone in my body, that was put on the scale and weighed against my personal trust in my father. And narrowly, personal trust in my father won out, just barely. And so I learned that personal trust in someone who loves me and knows me and whom I love and know, that is actually more true than my perception of reality, right? And by building that, by requiring that of our children in all the various stages, we're building that muscle that says, you know what? There's my perception of reality, my wisdom, right? My understanding weighed against trust in someone bigger than me, wiser than me, in the case of God, all-knowing, who made me and loves me infinitely. And so if I built that muscle with my father, it will be easier to build it with my heavenly father. But also, you talk about not dropping the kid. Yes, try not to drop the kid. And also, inevitably, actually dropping the kid, don't try to do it, but you will, right? And that's actually part of the education too, because they have to also learn that you're not the ultimate end, right? That you're fallible. And so there needs to be a foil, actually, also. They have to know that I trust my father. I trust my father. I trust. Oh, but my father is fallible, right? He's not ultimately trustworthy. Ah, but my heavenly father is, right? And so we must point away from ourselves.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, if you wrestle enough with your kids, you're going to learn that lesson, because you're going to bang their head on something, maybe your elbow, and they're going to say, ah, and start crying, and you'll have to console them. And then you get back to wrestling, hopefully. Hopefully it's not serious. But then you realize, okay, man, I went a little further than I could, and I didn't realize, you know, I wasn't paying close enough attention. But that's okay. That happens. And you're exactly right. You're ultimately teaching them to trust you more than they trust themselves, and thereby they trust God more than they trust themselves, because that's what you want when your kid is 47 years old and someone dear to him has just died in unexplainable circumstances, or in some way, shape, or form, it feels like his life is falling apart. You want him to say, I have limited perspective. This is terrible. It all sucks. And yet, I trust God more than I trust my perception of what's happening right now. I trust God more than I trust myself. And so I'll lean on him. I will be faithful to him, and he will see me through, right? And unlike Dad, he's not going to elbow me in the forehead on accident. So I mentioned Hebrews 12 earlier, and maybe we can now go into Hebrews 12, see some of these principles kind of playing out, how God does this with us, and then have some biblical warrant for doing this with our kids, and also see some examples of how God does it. And actually, interestingly, also the author of Hebrews does this as he's writing it. We'll see that clearly too. So do you want to just read through that section of Hebrews 12 and we can break it down?
Yeah, sure thing. So just starting from the beginning, because we've already talked about how the goal is to make our children like Jesus, which also incidentally means we have to be like Jesus too. So we'll get into that. This is verse 1. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinners, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. Right, so that in that intro, section, you see, okay, you've been given a difficult thing to do. You've got to overcome this opposition. And guess what? That's exactly like Jesus did. Jesus also had to overcome opposition. You are being like your elder brother in this sense. Verse 4, in your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. And have you completely forgotten this word of encouragement that addresses you as a father addresses his son? It says, my son, do not make light of the Lord's discipline, and do not lose heart when he rebukes you, because the Lord disciplines the one he loves, and he chastens everyone he accepts as his son. So this goes back to what we said in earlier episodes. You know, when you're giving your child a spanking, you're not giving them punishment. You're giving them chastisement, training, right? Correction, yes, but the whole idea is not to destroy, but to build up. So this is what the author of Hebrews is getting at here, right? The Lord disciplines the one whom he loves. The goal is to train him, to build him, to grow him, right? So then verse 7, endure hardship as discipline. God is treating you as his children. For what children are not disciplined by their father? I'll tell you which ones, the ones that are not loved by their father. Right? If you are not disciplined, and everyone undergoes discipline, then you are not legitimate, not true sons and daughters at all.
I want to make the point really quickly there that this section clearly shows us this discipline as you're speaking about. You already mentioned it, but God is treating us as sons, right? He's treating us like Christ himself. He is reproving us, he's correcting us, he's bringing us up into Christ's likeness through whatever means he needs to, right? When we think about, you know, suffering and hardship in our own lives, when we think about the correction of the Lord or his chastisement, we should really, in some sense, see that as what God saw as necessary and fit to conform us into Christ's likeness. So when hardship comes, or when suffering comes from our sin or whatever it is, we can look at that and say, okay, that's terrible. But also, praise be to God that he saw it fit to use this to point me back to him so that I could repent and grow in my maturity rather than letting me head off into sin. And he's treating me as a son by disciplining me. And this word discipline throughout the whole passage is the word paideia, right? He is paideia-ing us. He's nurturing and admonishing us, right? Again and again and again. He's teaching us how to tuck in our togas, and he's teaching us what virtues we should aspire to, and he's teaching us what it takes to be a citizen in the kingdom of God. That is the paideia of God that Paul in Ephesians is commanding the Greeks to abide by, rather than the paideia of the Greek culture. So we're pushing back against any other paideia and instead giving the paideia the discipline of God.
One thing you brought out that I think is important to come back to. Hardship is sometimes a result of sin, but sometimes hardship is for the sake of refining, improving, completing, right? And we see that most dramatically in the case of Christ himself. Christ suffered, but Christ did not suffer for his own sins, right? Christ endured hardship, but he did not endure hardship for his own sins, right? And we'll get to that in a minute here. Another example, though, is Job, right? Job did not suffer for his sin. He suffered, and he suffered in some sense to complete him. Toby Sumter has a wonderful commentary on Job called A Son for Glory that basically makes the argument that that's the whole point of Job, is that Job is being tested, trained, refined by suffering in order to be a son of God.
And heralded to Satan, right? He's being proven to Satan. That's why it's God who says, have you considered my servant Job? Lee had a beautiful way of putting this in one of his first sermons on Job. He preached through it a few years ago when he said, you know, Job doesn't see the behind the scenes like we do, but through all of the sorrow and heartache and suffering that he endures, God is holding him up as an example to the world, to Satan and the demons, of what faithfulness to God looks like. He's holding him up as one of the most honored men in the world because his life is an example of what it looks like to follow God faithfully.
So verse 9, furthermore, we have had human fathers who corrected us and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed for a few days chastened us as seemed best to them, but he for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. So, you know, Paul is using a, you know, from lesser to greater argument. He says, you know, we've been trained by our earthly fathers. We know what that was like, right? We have a picture of that. Well, God is like that, except for he's perfect, right? God is like that, except for he's ushering us into his holiness. That's why, right? And for our good, for our profit. And then verse 11, now no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterward, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Right, one of the great verses, both for enduring hardship in our own lives, but also for our children. This is, yeah, we get it, right? The 10-mile run is lame. Like, we don't, it's lousy. You feel horrible, right? The workout is horrible. The spanking is tough, right? It's not fun in the moment. It's not even fun directly after. But to those who've been trained by it long-term with sustained application and faithful submission, those people yield the peaceful fruit of righteousness.
And something that's so important here is to see that the fruit that's being yielded from the discipline, I think, is actually what he's referring to earlier. He's calling our attention to the fact that when we have earthly fathers who discipline us, who paideia us, we respect them for it. We actually gain respect as fathers by disciplining our kids. If we do it rightly, if we do it in a just way that honors God, we will gain their respect. And that will be particularly true, I think, when, as he says here, it bears fruit in their lives. When they bear fruit as 20 and 30 and 40-year-olds and look back to you pushing them to jump into the pool and to trust you, and they tie that idea to, oh man, I'm so glad that my dad was not content to let me wimp out, that he was not content to let me take the easy way out all the time. I'm so glad that he pushed me, that he made me do hard things, because I see it bearing fruit now. It has changed my character. It has formed who I am, and it yields righteousness. It yields good fruit. And because of that, I am not only respecting him in the moment, but now decades later, looking back, and I'm thankful for all of the lessons that he gave me.
Maybe it bears pointing out here that, just like we talked about, there's an asymmetry between the boys and the girls. There's also an asymmetry between the father and the mother. That this is uniquely in the father's wheelhouse, so to speak. And that's not to say that the mother never does that, obviously, right? Especially if, you know, if the mother is homeschooling or if she's with the little kids, of course, dad's away at work, right? So she's going to be doing a lot of it at home. But this does fit in the father's responsibilities more than the mother's, right? It's his job to push, to demand, to require performance from his children, and to do so lovingly and gently, right? But to do so firmly as well. And it's not to say dad never gives hugs, right? Of course, dad gives hugs. And it's not to say mom never spanks. Of course, mom spanks. But this is uniquely part of our calling as dads.
And one thing as an example there that you can think of, okay, where do those lines fall? How should we draw that in our own home? And maybe we can get more to that later, but as a principle, or maybe an example of a principle, perhaps, you can say it should be perfectly fitting if your wife is at home with the kids, homeschooling or just during the day, and you're not there, and the kids have been given some task to do, and it's hard, and they say something like, is this enough? Or, hey, can we go play now? Or whatever. It should be perfectly fitting and perfectly understood by your kids if your wife's response is, what do you think your father would expect? Right? Because if they have a good answer to that, if they do know your expectations, then she should be able to say that, and she doesn't then have to make the argument, right? She doesn't then have to show them how it's good, and they don't have to, in that sense, be asked to trust her. They're not, like, she's not demanding the hard thing of them on her own. She's pointing back to you and is saying, you know what your father would expect, right? You know that he has trained you to be able to do these things. And so I expect the same thing from you that he does, right? Go and do them and do it well, and do it with joy and gladness. And he'll be pleased when he sees the work that you've done or whatever it is, right? There's a simple kind of principle there that the burden, I think, is on us, like I said earlier, to set the tone and the pace and the direction of these sorts of things. And that should make it ideally very easy for our wives to cut with that grain. And they shouldn't be having to do a lot of that legwork on their own.
Yeah, exactly. And this also does fall into the stereotypical difference between the father and the mother that you see played out in you know, homes that are disordered, where the father becomes a tyrant and the mother then is the coddler, right? And that's playing to the tendencies of both. The father tends to not be gentle. The father tends to be a tyrant, and the mother tends to smother, to coddle. And you know, so you have the trope of the harsh, unrelenting father, right? And then the mother who always is scuttling in and saving the children from the father's oppressiveness, right? But she's also not doing them any favors either. So that's a trope for a reason. The goal is to have it not be excessive like that. But like you say, to have the mother keying off the father's tone, and for the father to not forget the frame of his children, and to not forget that he's not ultimate, and to not forget to be gentle and kind. Yeah. And I think to that end, you know, the next verse in Hebrews 12 is exactly right. It says, "Therefore strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather be healed." Right. And I think that we can take that and we can interpret it in this light, that our job is to endure, right? This is referring to the God's treatment of his children, right? That we're to endure, to be strong and to bear up under his instruction, under his chastening. But also it sets up the context for how we should think about our own chastening of our children. Okay, the goal is to not dislocate, but to heal. The goal is to make paths straight. The goal is for there to be joy and peace and liberty. And so if there is narrowness and constriction and obstacle and tension, that's for the sake of it being resolved. That's for the sake of there being.
Yeah, I love that the author with apostolic authority is telling the readers of this letter to do the very thing that he just said God does for us, right? So God disciplines, he chastens, he brings about hardship in order to prove us, in order to shape us. And then the author goes straight into an exhortation here. Therefore, lift your drooping hands, strengthen your weak knees, right? You are in some form of weakness. You need to strengthen yourself and walk upright and bear this well, because it will be a glory for you. It will be good for you. He's not doing this as a way to shame them. He's doing this as a way to lead to their blessing and their glory. And it's just so fitting then that it kind of leads directly into those next two verses. So I'll read these here. Strive for peace with everyone and the holiness, and for holiness, without which no one will see the Lord. See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled. So, interestingly, this is not necessarily the central point here, but I do think it's related, right? There's this idea of the root of bitterness springing up and causing trouble and division. And what we see is that by pushing our kids and then the apostle here pushing the readers of this epistle to endure hardship and to be strong under pressure, to maintain your virtue and come out the other side unscathed, you prevent bitterness. And there can often be, this is where I'm kind of going off the beaten path with the application, but there can often be this tendency to think, oh, I don't want my kids to resent me. I don't want them to become bitter because I'm pushing them. And there's real danger there. You shouldn't be totally oblivious to the fact that that's a real possibility if you're stubborn and if you're just totally oblivious to the effect that your words and demands have on your children. But that doesn't need to be the case. In fact, if you do this rightly, you prevent bitterness in your children. You help them to fight against bitterness when it's tempting in their own hearts. And they embrace the challenge. They embrace these hardships for what they are and endure them faithfully because you've trained them to do it. And that leads to greater affection for you. That leads to greater affection for anyone who's enduring the hardship with them or who's around them when they're in suffering of any kind. And it really goes a long way to helping them live at peace with God and with man around them.
Yes. Amen and amen. You wanna talk practicals? You want to get into it?
Oh boy, I do. So we've already mentioned a few, right? I think this one is practical in many ways, not just the practical of pushing your kids limits and teaching them to be brave, teaching them to trust you, but also just practically, like, I want my kids to be comfortable jumping in a pool. I don't want them to be scared and squeamish around water because it's dangerous. It's dangerous in the sense that if they're not learning to do this well, then they're not going to learn if I'm not teaching them, right? And I want them to do that when they're young so that it is natural as they age, right? So that doesn't have to be a battle that we're fighting with a 10-year-old who doesn't want to jump off the diving board because he doesn't really feel comfortable in the water. Like, I want them to feel comfortable in the water because that keeps them safe, actually. Teaching a kid to swim is the best way to stop them from drowning. And so I want them to embrace, okay, this is kind of unknown, this is kind of scary, but it becomes less scary because they're doing it with you from a very early age. And like, I'm not going to draw lines around when that should exactly be, but that's a practical thing of like, I want my kids loving and laughing as they jump off of high things into the water.
Yeah, a couple things there. One, beginning with the end in mind, thinking, okay, what are the small challenges I can put in front of them now when they're little that will set themselves up for the bigger challenges of tomorrow, right? Okay, so if I want my son when he's 18 to be able to endure hardship, like specifically, like if I want him to be able to, you know, take on a hard job, like that has him getting up at 4 a.m. and is physically demanding and has him out in the cold. Like, okay, if I want him to be able to do that then, what do we need to do now? Like, okay, if I want him to have the type of courage and, you know, backbone that's going to have him, you know, able to stand up to his friends when they want to do evil, right? When he's 18, what do I need to do now to set him up for that? If I want him to be the type who can, you know, ask a girl to marry him, okay, what do I need to do now to be setting him up for that then?
One thing there as well, there's a difference in wanting your children to be able to do something and hoping that it happens, right? So you might say to yourself, oh, well, I actually hope that my son doesn't have to wake up at 4 a.m. and go out into the cold for a highly demanding job. That kind of stinks. I'd rather him have an easier job than that. Well, okay, that's fine. That's not necessarily a bad thing to want for your kid, but you should want your son to be able to do that and to excel in doing that. Just like I want my son to have the kind of courage that would lead him on the battlefield to be the first to jump on the grenade and save his brothers in arms. I don't want that to happen to him, but I hope that he has the courage to do it, right? So that's maybe one quick clarification. Just as we think about the heading, that doesn't mean we're hoping for this outcome. We're just hoping that if this did come down the pike, he would be willing to endure it and able to endure it.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, not for any particular end, like earthly end, but I want him to have the type of soul that is able to obey his God, whatever his God requires of him. And I want him to be able to be the type of man who can obey his God when it's really hard, and thus through whom God can do great and mighty things, right? I want him to be great in faith. So thinking small, like super small, where does this start? Like, well, yeah, we use the example of like, jump to me in the pool. Like, that's huge. Jump to me on the stairs, right? Jump to me generally, right? Those are actually really important. When the toddler is starting to walk, like push them farther than they think they can walk. You feel horrible, sort of, but when they're toddling, move away from them. So they have to walk further. It's the same move. Right? I think I can go that far. You know, the child thinks I can go, you know, X. So you say, coolio, let's try X plus 2, right? Let's make you go further than you think you can go. And let's see what happens, right? So yeah, simple things like giving them food they've never tried before. I think you had that in your notes. I think that's great, right? Requiring of them adventure and requiring of them to submit to what's put in front of them. Right, regardless of whether they like it or not. Kelsa started, I love this. She started experimenting with sauces and she just calls every sauce she makes adventure sauce. And who knows what it's going to be, right? And so it's like, all right, kids, who wants some adventure sauce? And we're trying to teach them to go like, oh, yeah, me. I don't know what it is. Let's find out. Like, my mom thinks it goes well with this dish. Cool. She's right. Has been right in the past anyways. Like, yeah, so requiring them to submit to the food on their plate and to be adventuresome there. Other thoughts for, especially for the little guys?
Yeah, I think eating foods is great. We've talked about the other side of that, which is fighting against food fussiness. So you're doing yourself a lot of favors with many of these things, whether that's, you know, fighting those temptations around the dinner table or keeping them safe around the pool or keeping them from, you know, totally being irresponsible and breaking 17 bones on the playground, right? You train them little by little and you're always training them ahead of what they're able to do. But you're right, it's X plus two. It's not X cubed or X to the fourth, right? There's a difference in those two things. And so that takes wisdom. It takes discretion. But one of the things that you mentioned is, I can't remember exactly what word you used, but you demand these things of them at times. That's necessary. And I want to say at the outset, at times there have been moments where I've said, you need to listen to me. Like, look at my eyes. I'm sitting here treading water in the deep end of the pool or whatever, talking to Levi or Ezra on the diving board. You need to obey me. I'm about to give you a command. Jump into the pool. And that usually gets through to them. I think I've only spanked for that once or twice. And most of the time, it goes incredibly well. But there's this kind of attitude that you even want to cut against. Like, at least I've noticed this in my kids and other kids that I've been around. So it's probably just endemic of our human nature under the fall, which is there's sometimes a willingness to do a hard thing, but a hesitancy that leads to constant delaying and arguing, not even arguing like in a disrespectful way. Oh, I want to do this instead. I don't want to obey you. But like pleading, where what if I do this instead? What if I jump down from the side of the pool instead of the diving board? Or what if I sit down and then slide off the end of the diving board? And there are times where you just need to cut against that and say, no, this is what you need to do, and this is what you will do, or you're going to face discipline. Because, one, that's just incredibly motivating. And two, the hope is not to discipline them. The hope is that it cuts through that attitude, and that not only have they done the thing, whatever it is that you're asking them to do or commanding them now, but they've also fought against that desire of the flesh to kind of push back. I don't know exactly. I mean, maybe it's like a mix of sloth and cowardice, right? To push back against the hard thing and try to equivocate and get out of it and weasel your way around it in such a way that's compromised fatally, because it's not going to, you know, it's not a fatal thing. It can be tempting to cave in those moments and say, okay, well, I'm tired of arguing with you or whatever. But if you're willing to just draw a firm line, then there's no arguing anymore. There's no debating anymore. It's like, you do this or you don't, but we're going to have this resolved in 5 seconds. And there's no bad ramifications from them weaseling around it and figuring out, oh, I can actually talk my way out of hard things, because you just can't in life. You can't. And we don't want to teach them that that's their first instinct, right, is to weasel their way around it.
That's exactly right. And sometimes I will demand the thing now and say, yeah, this is an obedience issue, right? Before I was giving you an opportunity, now I'm giving you a requirement. You must, right? But sometimes, and I'll do this, to accomplish the same thing you're getting at, I'll say, yeah, no, whenever you're ready. Like, you're going to jump. There's no other way but jumping. You don't have to jump now. I want them to feel that inevitability, right? Like, oh, and then they afterwards go, huh, I spent 4 minutes like crying on the diving board. But then I still had to do the thing, right? There's no way. And it actually was fun when I did it. And I feel like a doofus for crying about it for 5 minutes, right? You want your kids to feel the inevitability that you're getting. I can't talk my way around this. I have to just do it. And I want them to feel the, you know, like you said, I want them to be able to obey. But I also want them to learn just the stupidity of waiting, right? Like, huh, I waited and I gained nothing. I was cold on the diving board. And I still had to do it. Next time I'm not going to wait, right? And if you can train that muscle, that's really good. Let's see, one other principle, and this applies all over the place in everything, but easy to please, hard to satisfy, that applies here. So when your child succeeds, when he does the thing that you asked him to do, when he overcomes the obstacle that you put in front of him, like you praise him to high heaven, and this, hugs and huzzas and hip hip hoorays and rewards and all that, and then what's the next challenge? Right. And like, that was awesome, kid. Cool. Now here's the next thing you're going to do. And maybe not right now. Right. But that was good. There's always another mountain. Right. That's impulse in them to rejoice over the thing they did. Right. To feel their father's pleasure, but to know, okay, what's next? Because there's always something next.
That's right. And another practical way that you can apply this principle very easily and with a lot of kids at different ages is finding a good playground. If you have one near you, we happen to be blessed with one across the road, which is incredible. But even if you have to drive a few minutes, then you can, or make one in your backyard. That's true. We don't have much yard to make one in, but that's, again, we don't have to take care of the one across the street, thankfully. Whatever you can do to find a good playground, and one that's not one of these modern playgrounds with like trampolines under everything that you fall on, and that's like there's no way to make mistakes, there's no real risk or danger, but a good playground where you have things set up for different ages, because then you can have your 3-year-old and your 5-year-old and your 7-year-old and your 9-year-old, and they can all be doing different things, and you can push them in different ways. And you can say, okay, we've conquered this thing. Great. That's amazing. I'm so proud of you. Where's the next challenge? Like, what's the next step up to being able to do this? So, for Levi, for instance, that looked like there's this tall, like 2-story loopy slide that is covered at the park across from us. And you have to climb up ropes to get to it. It's like this kind of cage of ropes where you climb in and you go back at a 45 degree angle through the ropes. But there's two of those, like there's a second story. And then there's the third story that you go down the slide. And he could do that with me bracing him from the time that he was 2. Like Ezra can do it now with my hands right there to catch him if he slips or something like that. Cause he'll fall a good ways, if he does fall. But the next step was, okay, you've done this and you're comfortable now. You're not slipping off every time. I want you to do it without me, right? Like there's no safety net here. And if you fall, you got to catch yourself. And he did. He would fall sometimes and catch himself on the ropes. And I was more proud of him for that than I was that he could do it with my hands near him. Like he would slip and catch himself and be hanging there and put his foot somewhere that he could see and keep going. And now it's actually funny. He could climb all the way to the top before he could actually climb up the platform to get to the ropes. Like the platform is 3 feet off the ground or something and he couldn't make it up. So now he's finally, like the last stage was actually the first step. He's figured out how to climb up to get to the ropes where I don't have to go and lift him to get to the starting point, which I found very comical. But anyway, you just find those next steps little by little and you keep pushing them. You keep going.
That setup that you talk about, I think that's a great paradigm and it can be applied to lots of things. Like, all right, you're going to do this hard thing with me. Now the next step is you do it without me. Right? That's just, you can apply that all over the place. One thing I love about the kids' school is they, from first grade onwards, they're required to run a mile every quarter. So they go out to a big, they're bussed out to like this, basically a bike track, and they've marked a half mile. And so the boys run out first, to clear the dragons in the path. And then the girls go after and they all have to run a mile. And the goal is to just not stop and whatnot. And parents are all out there. So this was Rose's first mile. Benaiah had major success at the mile last year. Turns out he's fast, right? His mother's side. So there's much setup for like, all right, Rose, this is like, all right, you're going to do it. And she was dreading it and she was afraid of it. And I said, okay, I'm going to run with you. And so I got out there and I ran with her and it was hard for her. I did fine. She really, on that last quarter mile, she really wanted to stop and was, crying about it, but she persevered and you know, I was right there with her, and she never stopped. We crossed the line, all good. So then the next mile, I was like, all right, I'm going to time you. Like, I'll be there, but I'm going to volunteer to be the timer, not running with you. Right? You got to do it. And you know what? She was faster. Like, she actually, not much faster, but a little bit, right? So that mode of like, here's a hard thing. I know it's hard. I'm going to do it with you. I'll be right there the whole time. Okay, good. We did it. Coolio. Now you're going to do it by yourself. I'll be watching, right? But you're doing it by yourself. That's a good pattern.
Anything physical, right? Any physical activity that's a dexterity challenge or an endurance challenge is good. And there are a lot of ways that can look. So you can run a mile at school. One of the things that that we do at our house, I remember when Levi was maybe like 1.5-ish, like 18 months or so. So he'd been walking for a while. I was changing a light bulb in our living room, and I brought out the stepladder. And it was a stepladder that I could get up into the attic with. So I only used like the first step or two, but it was tall. It was, you know, 5.5-6 feet tall. And he starts trying to climb up it. And so there was this moment where Megan was like, hey, do you want to leave this out? Is it okay if he goes up this? Like, you should be with him if he does, probably. And I said, yes, I want him to climb up it. And then I did go over and, you know, walk over and be there. She was right to point out that, okay, the toddler is going up the ladder now. Someone should at least watch. But that's, again, that's a good balance there between the mother and father dynamic, where she is seeing a concern, something that could happen, and her instinct is not to shut it down and take the ladder away. Her instinct is to call me and say, hey, is this something that he should be doing? Do you want to do this with him, or should we put the ladder away? But she's deferring to me. Is it part of the plan? And so, yeah, he loved it. He thought it was amazing. And then when he got to the very top, he was scared. But he came down. And I made him come down. I made him like climb, go through the motions of climbing down. I didn't just pick him up and pull him off, because it's actually harder to go down than it is to climb up. And I want him to see that, right? It's just a very practical lesson. So all kinds of physical things. And that does tend to make your kids more adventurous in a good way, right? Like I never really did monkey bars as a kid. I want my kids to do monkey bars, right? I want them to be climbing all over them and to be those kids in the playground who are walking on the tops of them. And they're not scared because they have mastery over their bodies and what they do.
On that note, that means also that your kid will be the one with his arm in a sling, and your kid will be the one with the broken collarbone. And we have to just be okay with that, basically. And you have to, don't be stupid. But you have to weigh and realize, like, okay, for the sake of courage in his soul, I am going to accept the fact that there will be, you know, damage to his body. And we'll try to make sure that we learn some things while he's still fairly, you know, plastic and bouncy. But don't expect that you can have the kids who walk across the monkey bars in the top and not also be the ones with their arm in a sling on occasion. Like, that's part and parcel. But that's all right. That's okay.
Yeah, and actually secular psychologists have studied this, even like that the rate of broken bones in boys has gone down to meet the rate of broken bones in girls from like 50 years ago. And it's because they're not allowed to do those things. They're not allowed to take risk. And so the effect is not, there's a segment, maybe a large segment of the culture that says, oh, great, like we've stopped breaking kids' bones as children. But the thing that they don't realize is, okay, at what cost? Like, boys don't break their bones anymore. And also, they're not men. Like, they don't take risk. They're not ready to meet challenges. They're whiny and complacent and want everything to be given to them. And like so many other things, right? We're never just dealing with the isolated, oh, my kid didn't break his collarbone, I'm so glad. I've arrived as a parent. Okay, but what did you miss because your kid never had that opportunity of failure and, you know, breaking a bone and learning?
Inevitably, we're going to have to land the plane a little bit, which is too bad because this is good. But we need to hit differences between boys and girls. So what you just said is exactly right. Sure, we have boys who don't break their bones, but we also don't have boys who become men. And there's this need in a boy for him to... Well, okay, maybe I'll illustrate it this way. We have the expression, such and such separates the men from the boys. We don't have an expression like that for the girls. Like, you don't say such and such, you know, separates the women from the girls. Like, you don't have that. Because there's a fundamental difference. And you could get weird with this, but I think that in the main, it's right. Girls become women sort of inevitably. Like, now that doesn't mean necessarily they're wise women or good women, but like, there's not this same sense of she has to prove herself. Like, she's actually going to become a woman regardless. But we all have this concept of a boy needs to become a man. Like, and he might not, right? A girl will become a woman inevitably. A boy might not become a man. He's got to show it. He's got to perform. He's got to be tested. He's got to be pounded and then come through the pounding. And so this is why you have all sorts of, you know, various cultures have their own manhood rituals. And we have a very complex society which lends itself, which does not lend itself to simple manhood rituals. But that doesn't mean the thing is gone. So when we are raising our boys, we want to be cultivating in them that I persevere when it's hard, right? Because I've got to be able to perform. I've got to be able to stand up under adversity. I've got to go and separate myself from the woman's world. And I've got to be able to walk out into the woods, right, and handle whatever bears and wolves are out there, right, and then come back. I've got to be able to do that. And a girl doesn't have to be able to do that. Now, she needs to be strong and resilient as well, right? So it's not a fundamental difference, but it also is. So when we are raising our boys, we are much more self-consciously putting obstacles in front of them and rewarding them for taking risks, rewarding them for taking initiative, for sticking their neck out there, right, when danger threatens. And for the girls, there's that same sort of thing, but it's more connected to it's more connected to the father personally. Like, you have to trust me, and you have to, like, I am providing security for you, and you need to be able to receive the security that I'm offering. You need to be able to receive and submit to the world that I'm making for you. And that's, I'm training you in that so that you'll be able to submit to your husband and receive the world he's making for you. Ultimately, so you'll be able to submit to your God, right? A husband isn't the end either. So, I don't know, for boys, you are applauding them for jumping off of things and for taking their swords and for getting whacked and, you know, being able to get back in there, for taking a hard hit in the rugby game, right? And then breathing through it and getting back in there. That's the sort of thing you're wanting to put them in high contact situations, right? High contact, both physically, like literally they need to hit stuff, but also high contact with adversity, challenges, even if they're academic challenges or, chores even. Like, high contact is the mode. Whereas with the girls, it's more like you want to train them in resiliency. You want to train them in to be able to persevere when things are hard, but not in quite that high contact, impact, perform sort of way.
I think that makes sense, because what you don't want to do is teach your daughters that in order to mature into a godly woman, they need to become like a godly man. And you don't want them to be measuring themselves, strictly speaking, against their brothers, if they have brothers. Now, maybe you only have girls, and so that's not a problem. But if you have both, right, you don't want them to look at your sons and think, he's going to expect me to do everything just like that too. You want them to understand what the boys are doing and respect it and even admire it, and then to also understand that there are nuances here where I can exude that same kind of virtue and it's going to look different. It's going to look more, like you said, like resilience rather than overcoming the world around you, right? So you have a boy thrown into football or soccer or something like that, and he overcomes the boys around him. And that's that's somewhat different than, yeah, a girl learning to bear up under pressure and under hard circumstance and endure hardship and be faithful and loyal and virtuous and wise and to be long-suffering. You know, all things that you want for both of your children, but they manifest differently in boys and girls. And that's because men and women are different. And that's a good thing.
Yeah. I think this pertains to, I think George Gilder talks about this in Men and Marriage, putting your sons and daughters in different types of sports and different types of athletics, because there's certain, it's not all equal. There's certain athletic and physical activities that lend themselves to masculine virtues, right? So football, high contact, even basketball and soccer to some extent, right? And soccer maybe goes both ways, but then on the girls' side, so for the boys, you know, high impact, what requires strength and performance, and for the girls, more physical activities that lean towards the aesthetic, right? That are about adornment and beautification as opposed to overcoming, right? So gymnastics, dance, you know, ballet, even a sport like volleyball, I think is actually a really, really lovely feminine sport, involving, yeah, kind of that give and take, that working together, that sort of fluid, harmonious thing, as opposed to the, you know, stomp over their faces ness, which is present in other sports. So thinking hard about, okay, what sort of obstacles am I putting in front of my girls? And are those obstacles in tune with how God has made women to be or not?
Yeah, I think some maybe characteristics of those just descriptive words would be like for the girls, for, you know, volleyball or gymnastics or whatever, you have, you know, balance, you have grace and dexterity, elegance, right? Beauty. And then for the boys, there's some of that at times, right? There's something beautiful about a perfect football play that every time everybody's timing is in sync, but there's also something that you want them to learn, which is a kind of brutality of strength against strength and pushing your strength beyond its limits in a way that you don't really ask your girls to do. And you see that, and the kids know that, right? We're not fooling them by playing soccer with a boys' team and a girls' team. It looks totally different. And it's not just because the boys are stronger and faster and bigger than the girls and they would beat the girls' team. That's true, but the sport is played totally differently. There's more finesse. There's more, maybe a greater emphasis on finesse and accuracy and care and precision in the girls' game. And there's a much greater emphasis in the boys' game on speed, power, strength. How hard can I knock you shoulder to shoulder and get you on the ground without getting a foul, right? That's essential if I'm going to play in 10th grade against seniors in high school because they're men and I'm not yet. And I've got to be able to take a hit in soccer and not get knocked down because otherwise I'm going to get pulled and I'm going to get sat down on the bench and I don't get to play anymore. So it's just a different kind of game in that regard where like the kids will naturally play it differently. And there's nothing wrong with that. That is okay. In fact, it's something to be cultivated and encouraged because they're playing to their strengths and what it is that they need to be learning and doing.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe to sum up that, it's all right to put trials in front of your boys and trials in front of your girls, but those won't be the same trials. And we need to take thought for the types of trials you're putting in front of your boys and the types of obstacles you're putting in front of your girls.
Yeah, I think that's right. One last thing, maybe one and a half. You already mentioned chores. I think emphasizing chores that take a lot of hard work and being particular about those chores is important. So that doesn't mean being, you know, overly persnickety about exactly how something is done. You know, if you wanted the forks just so, and they were set slightly askew on the napkin before dinner, right? That maybe is overzealous, but you know, if the forks are on the wrong side, then they haven't set the table properly, right? If that's a standard that you gave them and that they know, you know, they haven't met your expectation in the details.
Quick note on that. That's actually an example maybe of a difference between a boy challenge and a girl challenge, right? If I ask my girls to set the table, maybe I actually do want it to be just so, like, and I want it to be centered, and I will critique if it's not, because that's, I'm wanting that attention to detail, that attention to the appearance, the the harmony and adornment aspect is actually what I'm looking for. And for the boys, you know what? If the forks get on the table in the vicinity of the plates, I'm good.
Yeah, and so just thinking of ways that you can push them to do the job excellently and not just get the job done is essential, because you're training them to do all that they do with excellence.
Key part of this is giving them responsibility over the thing, like owning it. Big increase in our chore system was when we started giving rooms of the house to individual children for either, you know, a week or a day or whatever. Like, this is your room. Like, you're the one to tidy it. It falls upon you. Now take ownership of it. And I know it's super messy and really big. Yeah, boy, oof, this is tough. Man, oh man. We should cry for a little bit. Yeah, let's cry. Okay. We're done crying? Good. All right, back to it. Right. And giving them that ownership of it, which inevitably means that they will do it badly, right? So budgeting, when you're budgeting for failure, which should be present all the time when you're pushing your kids' limits, if you're doing so effectively, they'll fail 20, 30, 40% of the time, right? Maybe 40 is a little high. 20, 25, right? That's right. 1 in 4 maybe is a good rule of thumb. 1 in 5 of the things you push them to do, they should fail at. Because otherwise, you're not really pushing them. It only looks like you're pushing them. But when that comes to chores, that means they're good. I mean, you know, 1 time in 5, the chore's not going to get done well. And you got to just be okay with that. And say, all right, nope, you didn't do that right. Let's go back and do it again. Or you didn't do that well this time. We're going to do better next time. And we have to be, it's harder for us to be okay with that when it's like our house and like, oh, you didn't clean up the way I told you and company came and they're here. Right. Which is different from them falling off the monkey bars, like, which doesn't actually affect me. So they've got to have ownership over the thing. That means it'll be done badly. That's the way it goes.
Yeah, that's right. And giving them those opportunities to fail also allows you to have those conversations following up, where sometimes it's going to be a discipline issue and you're getting some attitude and the kid just doesn't really care and wants to blow off the work, in which case you can discipline for that. And sometimes it's going to be a failure for some other reason, right? It was too much for them, or they didn't notice this part of it that they left undone. And you can talk about that and you can say, okay, this is what you missed, and either go back and correct it, like you said, or, you know, teaching them for next time. That's great. The last thing that kind of area that I would say is big and an easy one with all of your kids is being outside in the weather and pushing them to endure the cold and the hot and the mosquitoes and the rain and all of that without complaining, and to do it with joy. So this is a constant conversation for us. And I tell them that it's, you know, that we're doing this because it's good for you. And I know it's hard, but it's okay. It's too cold, or your nose is running, or it's really hot and you're sweaty and you want to go inside, but we're not. We're going to stay outside, actually. And we'll go inside when it's dinner time, and then you can get in the shower after that and clean up or whatever. But we're going to endure this. And one of the things that heightened my resolve on that even more is that we've committed to at least trying this year to do 1,000 hours outside. We're not going to get there, but man, with that goal, we have spent so much more time outside. And it's just good, right? And so Megan was, you know, reading something from some mom who had, you know, tried to do this or talked about the importance of getting outside or whatever. And she was saying, like, you know, you come up with all these excuses not to get your kids outside in the middle of the day, and the timing is perfect, and you don't have that much to do at this instant, but you still don't go outside. Like, is it the mosquitoes? Is that the problem? Because you can just get over that. And like, that's so true with mosquitoes or with 95 degree weather or 30 degree weather. You can just get over it, right? Like, it's okay to be uncomfortable. It's actually good for you to be uncomfortable and for your kids to be uncomfortable. And obviously, again, you know, you can get a heat stroke, so don't be crazy. But get outside. Enjoy the weather, because it's a natural way to get them playing the way you want them to be playing already and enjoying God's creation, and also to be teaching them this kind of endurance.
And that, again, that's just a paradigmatic thing of like, submit to the world God made, right? God made the world and you have to live in it. And we're going to do that on like the most basic physical carnal level. Like, I'm going to go outside and submit to what God said that the sun would be doing today, or what the sky would be doing today. And I'm going to endure it. I'm going to endure it cheerfully. and I'm going to enjoy it and find that there actually is always something to enjoy.
Well, I think we're coming up on time here, so let's land the plane. What book recommendation do you have for us today?
Well, in the vein of being outside, that actually was fitting. My recommendation is one that I adored as a child. It is the American Boys Handy Book. I think a while back, Jameson, you recommended the Dangerous Book for Boys, which is wonderful, but it actually didn't fill the central place in my heart and mind as a boy. The one that did was the American Boys Handy Book by Daniel C. Beard. It was one of the founders of Boy Scouts of America back when it was good. This is just, I don't know, it's turn of the century, so you know, late 1800s, early 1900s, and it just is a practical extravaganza of all sorts of things that boys can do, should do, and it's a wealth of outdoor activities, indoor activities, you know, things to try, things to make, things to do. It really shaped my imagination as a child, as a young boy, as to what I thought was possible, and you know, gave me a vision for the world that's full of potential and full of excitement and full of adventure. So American Boys Handy Book, Beard, good book.
All right. And I'm going to recommend The Jungle Books this week by Rudyard Kipling. This is a well-known, well-beloved collection of stories largely revolving around animals in the Indian wilderness, starring obviously Mowgli and Baloo the bear and Shere Khan the tiger and Rikki Tikki Tavi. But there are many, many short stories that are kind of one-offs in the whole world of the Jungle Books that you may not have heard of. So I just encourage you to get those. They're easy to read to your kids, even from a young age. We were just reading Rikki Tikki Tavi last night and finished it up. And I remembered that one fondly from, you know, being a kid. So this books that my dad read to me when I was a kid, and now I'm reading them to the boys, and it's a lot of fun. I mean, you can't go wrong with animal stories, and these are maybe the best animal stories. At least, you know, they're up there in the top three, probably. So, yeah, The Jungle Books by Rudyard Kipling.
Good stuff. Rikki Tikki Tavi's a gem. Yeah.
And on that note, we want to say thank you for joining us today on the podcast. We hope you've enjoyed it and had a good time thinking through these things alongside us. If you would like to support the show and help us keep it going, you can find a link to our Patreon below in the show notes. We would love to have your support. It would go a long way to helping us pay for hosting and editing and those sorts of things to make this a long-term project. I also want to say thank you to Shane Caver for the use of our theme music and to ETC Media for editing the podcast. You can see links to their work below in the show notes as well. And with that, we hope you've been blessed and edified by the show.
Don't be hasty.
Death celebration.
Oh, that's it. Yeah. Got it. That's
You're
it.
Welcome.
Thank you. Yeah.